And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matsuda.
And welcome, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, and it's great to be with you today. Love talking apologetics, and, you know, one of the blessings that I have in doing this show is that I often get to speak to people that I have admired and followed over the years, and today's guest is one of those people. I've been following his career since... I don't know when. I guess way back when he was doing a broadcast with Scott Hahn. I just thought, this guy is so articulate, so knowledgeable, and just an interesting character. In fact, if for those longtime listeners of Hands-On Apologetics, you'll remember in my trip out, we did the mobile dojo. We went to the world headquarters at the Palatial Virgin Most Powerful Studios, and I had this particular guest on my show live in that studio, and that is none other than Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold's going to join us, and we're going to talk about his book, Confession of a Traditional Catholic. Great stuff. It's always fun to talk to Matthew. He's so entertaining, so I can't wait to have him on and just sit back and enjoy the program, to tell you the truth. But I've been wanting to talk about his book because his journey of faith is interesting, even within the Catholic Church. And he's got so many great insights, too. So Matthew Arnold's going to join us after the first break. That's going to be tons of fun, people. And also, we're going to do our usual exercises that we do here because we need to sharpen our critical thinking skills, learn a little bit about the early church fathers, and you know, all of these things are components and skill sets that will come in handy when you're talking to someone who maybe has objections about Catholicism, maybe misunderstandings. You can use these things. And so we're going to do the finding of the fallacy. The finding of the fallacy for today is the fallacy of division. And we're also going to meet an early church father. Today's early church father is Saint Clement of Alexandria. So, which is a very interesting father indeed. So if you have any questions for Matthew, give us a call after the break at 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And also, you can send your emails to questions@handsonapologetics.com. And it's time for our shout-outs, folks, to those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube below. Greetings, everyone. Thank you for the emojis. That's Pauline, that's a very different and colorful emoji explosion. Thank you. It's great. I love the live feeds. And I also love you, the listeners who are listening on radio and podcast. Welcome aboard, everybody. And if you're listening and you want to listen to our conversation with Matthew, you can take it with you while you're exercising or doing the chores or whatever. You can just download it as a podcast. We're on all sorts of podcast servers, but the easy place to go to is the flagship website for Virgin Most Powerful, which is Virgin Most Powerful Radio, that's all one word, .com. And just click on shows, scroll down to Hands-On Apologetics, and bang, there's all the programs we've done available in audio format. Not only our program, but also all the other great programs as well. So, good stuff. Let's see. Why don't we jump to our finding the fallacy? And the finding the fallacy for today is the fallacy of division. Now, no, this is not a math problem, folks, but it is a logical fallacy. What is the fallacy of division? Well, it's actually, you know, the opposite of another fallacy known as the fallacy of composition. So you have composition and you have division. They're flip sides of the same thing. Okay, so what is the fallacy of division? Well, it's committed by inferences from the fact that a whole has a property to the conclusion that part of all the parts of the whole or a part of the whole also has that same property. Okay, so what you're doing is you're making an improper inference from the whole to a part. Okay. And, of course, the flip side of that is composition, which you probably guessed that the properties of the part are illegitimately inferred to the whole. Okay, so let's talk about division. Moving from the whole to the part. Okay, let's say water. Okay, water has the property of being a liquid, right? Now, you can make the improper inference that because water is a liquid, then its constituent parts of hydrogen and oxygen, those molecules must also be liquid. See how that just doesn't follow, does it? Although they're parts of H2O, obviously, nevertheless, the combination of the two have create a different property, liquid. Or you can think of it this way, too. And airplane usually is the standard model for fallacies of division and composition. You can say an airplane is too heavy to lift, which is true. Therefore, each of its parts must be too heavy to lift. Okay, which is obviously false, right? Because there's many, many parts on an airplane that is quite light. So you can't infer from the whole to every part. And that is, as I said, the fallacy of division. So, keep that in mind, division, composition, and you'll be amazed at how many different ways this particular fallacy comes about. All right, so let's go to the Meet the Early Church Father for today. And the Meet the Early Church Father is St. Clement of Alexandria, who was born sometime around AD 150, died around 211, 216. Okay, and he's a very interesting father. He's his full name is Titus Flavius Clemens, also known as St. Clement of Alexandria. He was born to pagan parents, probably in Athens, sometime around the year 150 AD. After becoming a Christian, he journeyed to Italy, Syria, and Palestine, seeking Christian teachers for his instruction. And then finally, he met the celebrated Pantaenus in Alexandria, and was so attracted to this master. By the way, Pantaenus was a hero of the apostles. He was so attracted to this master that he settled there and became, in order, Pantaenus' pupil, associate, assistant, and then finally he succeeded him as the director of the School of Catechumens in Alexandria, attaining the latter position around the year 200 AD. So for two or three years later, he was forced by persecution to flee from Egypt, and he later died in Cappadocia between the years 210 and 216, somewhere around there, without having seen Egypt again. So it is kind of a sad ending for him. If you ever get a chance to read St. Clement's writings, you'll find that he loves to pull in learning from every sphere you could think of. So if he could find things in pagan Greek writings, he'll use them. If he could find things in ancient Jewish writings, he'll use them. He'll use poetry. He'll use any kind of resource and try to show how the wisdom that created the world and also is embodied in Jesus Christ, you know, that all true wisdom ultimately finds its center in Christ. So it's interesting reading. It's kind of like doing a course in ancient literature almost. He's known for three famous works. So you apologists out there, you should know the three famous works of Clement of Alexandria. First one's his Exhortation to the Greeks, which is written about 200. It's the first of Clement's three great works. It's an early member of Christian apologetics. But still, you know, Clement has that new approach, that different approach to things. And he no longer finds it necessary to rescue Christianity from the onslaught of slander and calumny. Rather, he is deeply concerned with the educative function of the word, the logos, the divine word, throughout the history of mankind. This being his concern, the work bears some claim to being a theology of history. So that's kind of cool. The second of the three great works is the Instruction of Children, also known by the Greek word pedagogos. And that's around 202. He develops the idea of the educative function of the logos, or word, divine word, who is present as an instructor or tutor of converts in the conduct of their lives. He gets into that, and also problems of the homely affairs between Christians in a pagan society. It's an extremely informative work, Juergens tells us. in that Clement appears as a kind of third century Emily Post in that work. Now, that's, of course, Jurgens, you know, Faith of the Early Fathers that we used for this segment. He always has some sort of humorous comments. The third of the three important works of Alexander, Clement of Alexandria, is the Stromatis, or the Miscellaneous, or Miscellanies, I guess you could say. This one Clement remarks that the word first exhorts, then trains, then teaches us. And in a sense, what it is kind of a catch-all work. He goes into all sorts of different topics, gleaning information from the other three and expanding on them. It was meant to be a trilogy, that Clement intended to write three books. And so this last work, the Miscellanies, I guess you would say, is kind of the capstone of that trilogy. And just scanning through here, the term Stromatis is interesting because the title of this book is suggestive of a tablecloth or bedcloths or horse blankets or throw rugs, essentially a patchwork that you would make, you know, a quilt would be made out of little pieces of material. And that's essentially what the title of this book is. So that's our early church father for today, Clement of Alexandria. Very interesting character indeed. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to meet another very interesting character indeed. Master apologist Matthew Arnold is going to join us. Listen to Hands-On Apologetics. Stay tuned. More to come your way after this.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
In Luke 7, Jesus said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven her, because she has been shown great love." According to St. John of the Cross, Christians should always remember that the value of their good works is not based on number and excellence. Their value is based on the love for God that prompts them to do the works. May we always be motivated by true love for God, and not worry so much about what we do, but why we do it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back to Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to have our guest. This is, like I said before, this is a person I've admired over the years. And that admiration has only grown, and that is none other than Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold is a Roman Catholic speaker, author, and producer. He's a conversion to the Catholic faith in 1996. Matthew created and produced several nationally known broadcast Catholic radio programs, including Reasons for Faith Live. He hosted Scripture Matters Live with Dr. Scott Hahn, and also Shield of Faith on Radio Maria. He's a former creative director for St. Joseph Communication. He's produced and put together some incredible audio and video presentations through them. And he's also the author of numerous articles, the founder of Pro Maltese Media. He holds a certificate in Christian counseling, and he has a book which should be on everybody's bookshelf, in my humble opinion, and that is Confessions of a Traditional Catholic. And Matthew Arnold, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Well, thank you, Gary. I couldn't agree more. No home in America is complete without a copy of Confessions of a Traditional Catholic. I think we pretty much get that out right now. I also want to say I enjoyed the first segment, particularly the Finding the Fallacy segment. I always like that. I think that would make a swell name for a book, by the way, Finding the Fallacy. So if you find the time. And it's also a fun game to play with your kids when they bring you stuff, articles from the internet.
Yeah, right.
ATL believes. You say, let's play Find the Fallacy with this, shall we?
Yeah.
Anyway, great to be here, Gary.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, the only thing is I would worry that that would be a challenge, that people pick up the book, you know, trying to find the fallacy and be explaining the fallacy. So, you know, I was a little, I'm always leery about giving a bio to someone who's going to talk about their life story, because, you know, it's like, well, here's a story. Okay, now, Matthew, tell us your story, you know. But why don't we start with this? How did you, where did the idea of Confessions of a Traditional Catholic come about? You know, where did it come about?
Well, actually, you know, there is kind of a long story involved in that. I'm a convert to the Catholic faith, and I wound up for a while in my search for a reverent liturgy out here in the wilds of Southern California. I actually wound up at one point outside the diocesan structure. And after Summorum Pontificum, the document that was issued motu proprio by Benedict XVI, I found my way back into full communion with the local ordinary, which was a joyous occasion, as you might imagine. And I was talking shortly after that to Scott Hahn, who said, don't write a book or go on a lecture tour, just let the dust settle. And then a few years later, I got a phone call from that same Scott Hahn who said, you know, I think it's time for you to write that book now. and I said to him, if I do that, I'm going to have to tell my whole story and how I, you know, stepped outside of the diocesan structure and attended illicit mass and so forth. And he said, yeah, well, so be it. And I told him, if you're kind enough to write a foreword, I'll be happy to write the book. And so I did.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's, so, you know, Scott Hahn put a bug in your ear to put it all down on paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, so, it was largely because, I mean, he could see the challenges of, I think, young people at Steubenville were very conflicted. Some of them, you know, going off campus to attend the traditional Latin Mass. He had a lot more homeschool kids and stuff. And then also seeing kids that had very much engaged the culture and very much been part of that Steubenville evangelistic mentality who go out into the world and wind up losing their faith.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So, you know, so really it's not like, what I want to say, it's part and parcel with your whole journey of faith from the beginning, isn't it? That, and maybe, for those who, I don't know who wouldn't be familiar with you, but maybe for those who aren't, well, maybe you can kind of give us a nutshell version of, you know, tell us a little bit of your journey to faith all the way up to, you know, when you started looking outside the diocese.
All right. Well, it all began at a 40-watt radio station in Fresno, California. No, that's somebody else's story, actually. I was raised in an atmosphere of generic Christianity. Okay. My parents, like millions of other families in the early 60s, kind of fell away from regular church attendance. And I was just a toddler at the time. So I didn't really have any religious formation. I mean, I was unchurched, as they would say. We did have the practice of grace before meals and prayer before bedtime, you know, Christmas tree, Easter eggs, the same as the culture. But I didn't have any kind of religious training or you know, church going experience or anything growing up. And in that doesn't mean I never had any brushes with Christianity. I did in junior high, then in high school, I had friends who got involved primarily in fundamentalist groups who tried to evangelize me. And I, at this time, you know, by the time I was in high school in the 70s, I was got involved in New Age type beliefs and practices. Mm-hmm. And thereby hangs a tale. I'll leave that for those who want to read the book. Yeah. But I got very involved in those kinds of things. And ultimately, though, I just kind of wrote Christianity off, and I kind of wrote everything off, you know, and became essentially just practically agnostic. Hmm. And then, you know, I wound up falling in love with a Catholic girl, and she was very subtle in her evangelization. You know, I was a musician when we first met and making my living that way. And so typically the only day off I would have was Sunday, and, you know, and we would get together in the evening because I would sleep during the daytime because I was up all night. And I can recall many times calling her and saying, well, you know, shall we go out tonight? And she says, yeah, why don't you come and by my, and she lived with her folks, you know, why don't you come by my folks' house around 5 o'clock? And then I'd get there and she's like, oh, you know, I didn't go to mass today. So there's a church right around the corner. We can go to the evening mass there. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, but so like I say, subtle, you know, they had those subtle evangelization techniques. And she was, you know, weirdly convinced that I was the right guy to marry, but didn't understand why, considering I wasn't Catholic. And then when our first son was born, you know, we were married in the church, and I promised to raise the kids Catholic and didn't take RCIA. And the priest that was helping us through the process just made me promise that when the kids came, started having questions, that I would take instruction at that time.
Okay.
Because you can't give what you don't have. And if you're going to raise your children Catholic, you have to have some idea about what the church teaches.
Very wise.
And yeah. Makes perfect sense. When Macklin was not quite 3 years old, our first son, he had a question. He asked his mom why everybody went to communion except for him and daddy. You know, and that's in his experience. Obviously, there were more people that didn't go to communion except for
right.
us. But, you know, I always went to church with them as, you know, out of solidarity and being a good dad and all that. And she said, you know, go ask your dad. Right. And so I took instruction and didn't intend to convert, actually made that announcement the first day. You know, they always go around the room, who are you and why are you here? What's your name? You know, I'm Bob and I'm getting married in the church and, you know, I'm right. chill and I never got confirmed. And it came around to me and I said, my name's Matthew and I have no intention of becoming Catholic. I'm only here to find out what you people believe.
so that what was their reaction, by the Matthew. Way?
You know, it was funny. I think that people didn't quite know how to take it, and people still quite don't know how to take me sometimes. The priest, however, was not phased in the least. And he was just this perfect storm. You know, he had fallen away from the faith himself as a young man. And, you know, he was raised Catholic, but became kind of a Pentecostal believer, you know, Assemblies of God type, and then had a very powerful reversion. Felt the call to the priesthood, went to Rome, graduated summa cum laude from the Gregorian, was ordained by St. John Paul II himself, and then came back to Garden Grove to teach me RCIA, because that's how the Holy Spirit works.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was intellectually, when we got to the apostolic succession, the penny dropped for me. I'm going, okay, this is why it's different. My Bible-believing friends seem to have, you know, think that the Bible fell from the sky, you know, bound in leather with gold edging on the pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I thought, well, if you make up a religion on a book and you believe the book is true because the book says it's true, that's kind of circular reasoning. And it didn't appeal to me.
Right.
But now it's like, no, see, we got around week six was the apostolic succession. Jesus founded a church and then the church gave us the Bible. It's like, oh, well, that's very different indeed.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the intellectual linchpin of my conversion. But the reason I converted is because people were praying for me, because my wife had been praying for me ever since she was a little girl. You know, even before we met, she started, when she discerned she didn't have a vocation to the religious life, she started praying for the man she was going to marry someday. Yeah. And the priest had us starting every class praying the rosary with the intention that the, you know, our Blessed Lady would speak to her spouse, the Holy Ghost, and he would enlighten our hearts and minds. And, you know, got to be careful when you do that stuff.
That's true. That's true. Now, did he institute that after your introduction that you have no intention of being Catholic, or was this?
Yes, he did. As far as I know, it was not his plan. But the next week, he came in with rosaries and pamphlets for everybody.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and what he said was, "I don't know that I've got enough time to teach you everything there is to know about Catholicism, so we're going to sacrifice some time, and you know, in prayer." And so I tell people, you know, I pray the daily rosary still, but I started praying the rosary before I was even baptized.
Wow. Yeah. Boy, that's powerful. And look at the results.
It's the gift of faith, you know. I really did. When I thought about the apostolic succession, you know, well, Gary, you deal with Protestant converts all the time. And, you know, I think a lot of our Protestant friends look at the Bible like a man looking down a well, right? Well, a man looking down a well can see nothing but a long, dark tunnel in his own reflection at the other end.
Yeah.
And I think some of our separated brethren, they do that. They look at the New Testament, you know, like they're looking down a long, dark tunnel, and they see their own reflection. They project themselves onto the New Testament and then kind of ignore everything that happened between then and now.
Yeah,
you know, and I honestly got a vision exactly, but a mental image of Pope John Paul II standing at a long line of popes that went all the way back to Peter. And I'm like, oh, see, that makes sense now because, you know, we understand what the Bible is because we were there the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, we understand what the teachings of Jesus are because we were listening and then passing them on and so forth. And when that happened, I had that, you know, where it just all suddenly made sense to me. I had this, you know, moment of clarity, and I really wanted to be Catholic, you know. Mm-hmm. And the next week I told the priest, and interestingly, if you knew me, it would be interesting, better. I told him I wanted to convert. I hadn't told my wife yet. I wanted it to be a surprise, I guess, because I don't know what's wrong with me. But I told, you know, she found out when I told the priest, what do I have to do to be baptized? And she started to cry, and so did I. And I was saying, I was trying to thank him, find the words to thank him. And he said, yeah, I had nothing to do with it. That's the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And really the idea, I mean, coming to grips with the idea of a personal God is pretty powerful.
Yeah.
But then coming to the realization that that personal God actually cares about, you know, me personally, that he has a concern for me. That was big.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, sending this priest all the way to right where you are when you need it to say the right things. Yeah, it's funny how in hindsight you can really see that.
It is. Yeah, you're looking back with the eyes of faith. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, we're chatting with Master Apologist Matthew Arnold about his book, Confessions of a Traditional Catholic, and more to come on the other side of the break. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics. I'm Gary Machuda. Be right back.
Hi, this is Barbara Nicolosi, and we're having a women's conference here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina on September 7th, 2019. This is going to be a great, great day for you to come and meet a bunch of new friends, wonderful Catholic women who want to deepen their Catholic faith and their understanding of themselves as women. You know, this era right now that we're in, so much confusion. What is it to be a man? What is it to be a woman? You know, the Catholic Church has a lot to say about this, and we're going to hear about them. We're going to hear about John Paul II's letter on women that he wrote from Mary Danielle Barber. She's going to talk about that. She's going to talk about Mary as a model for all of us. It's a topic that we can never reflect on too much. I'm going to talk about Teresa of Avila and the interior castle and how a mystical marriage is what all of us should be called to or are called to as Catholics in our prayer lives, and especially as women in the church. Aileen Blakowski is going to talk about motherhood and homeschooling. And then finally, we have Father Charles Murray. He's going to be the celebrant of the Eucharist. He's going to be here hearing confessions. It's going to be an amazing day. We're going to have an hour of adoration together, time to pray, time to laugh, eat, reflect, grow in our passion for our Catholic faith and our identity as Catholic women. You don't want to miss it. You want to come. You want to bring your friends. You want to bring your daughters, your nieces. That's really an affordable day. So go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org, and you can register for this conference or call 877-526-2151. The Women's Conference is going to be a great event for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles area, Southern California Catholics. You don't want to miss it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with the host of Happy Hour, which you can hear on Virgin Most Powerful on Fridays from 1 to 2 Pacific time. And that is none other than Matthew Arnold. Matthew, yeah, you know, you made me laugh because I was thinking, I would do the same thing. If I decided I'm going to convert, I'd like try to spring it on my wife. You know, hey, guess what? You know, but yeah, boy, how moving. And, you know, thanks be to God that he gave you that grace to come into the church.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that would be, it'd be great if that was the and that's the happy ending moment. You know, I'm in the church now. Everything's great.
Yeah, and then you died, and that was
it. Yeah, right. Unfortunately, you know, I mean, when I came into the church, it was 1996. We didn't really have all of the apologetics stuff that we have today. I mean, the internet was brand new, barely off the ground. Even St. Joseph Communications, Catholic Answers, they were still relatively new apostles. The whole Catholic lay evangelization thing was still not really mainstream, you know, in the church. Mm-hmm. And so I cut my teeth as a fledgling apologist on things like Faith of Our Fathers by James Cardinal Gibbons and Catholic Church Has the Answer by Paul Whitcomb and, you know, the Father Leo Haydock's Bible commentary with the old Douay Rheims Bible, right? Okay. On all the great stuff that was being put up by Tan Books. And unfortunately, I mean, and I got involved very quickly in lay apostolate. I come sometimes joke that the oil wasn't, you know, was still wet on my forehead when I started doing a lay evangelization. I went to work with St. Joseph Communications just in the second year after my conversion, you know, helping them with their radio apostolate and that sort of, because I had an entertainment background and it seemed like a logical step. I really wanted to be involved in some kind of evangelization or some sort of apostolic work. But the deeper I got into the Catholic lay apostolate, the greater my apprehension over the tension that I found between the, you know, traditional teaching of the Catholic Church on the one hand, which, by the way, has no expiration date, and my actual experience of Catholicism, you know, in the pew on the other hand.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I so fell in love with the liturgy that its abuse was really painful to me.
Yeah.
That and a lot of, you know, and a lot of heterodox homilies and all this kind of crazy stuff. And when I first came in, our little parish is gone now. It's was in Garden Grove. That's that church is no more. But at the time, you know, it was kind of this conservative little parish. It was sort of an oasis. I didn't realize that at the time, you know, and I was already hearing kind of these horror stories and going, golly, things must be really tough out there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and then when our pastor retired and they brought in the new group, and it was just, whoa, boy, things were suddenly very different. I had my whole, you know, I had the whole, liturgical renewal, revolution thing in microcosm at my church that the whole church had gone through some years before, you know. Yeah, right. I kind of got hit with it all at once. And I discovered a traditional mass that was being said under the old John Paul II's Ecclesia Dei indult. It was an elderly priest down in one of the beach cities. There's a little jewel of a church that was left over from the old days. And man, when I went to that traditional Latin mass, I didn't know what was going on, but I felt like a crucial puzzle piece had fallen into place. I mean, this is what I was looking for all along. I didn't even know it, yeah. You know, but here it is. It's lex orandi, lex credendi. The way you pray is the way you believe. These people are doing it right.
Yeah.
And I told the wife, I just want to come here, you know, once a month you know, just because it was kind of a long drive, but just to keep my sanity. And it was funny because when we went to that first traditional mass, I mean, my wife was born in 64. So she, you know, the interim mass was already a thing when she, you know, was born. Mm-hmm. And so she is all pretty much, you know, had that Novus Ordo new mass formation. Right.
Right.
But we went to this traditional mass. All she knew for sure was that it was going to be in Latin and that you're supposed to wear a veil. Right. And her mom had, we had lost her to cancer and she had gone through some of her things and found her, her old veil. So she put the veil on and we had several kids by this time and we left him with her sister. Cause I don't know, you know, Betty was afraid they were going to get some traditional cooties on him or no, actually what it was, she told me, she said she was afraid they were going to be fussy and she assumed that it was going to be a church full of old people, you know? And you know, you go to traditional mass, you can hear a pin drop. You don't want to, you know, have fussy kids there. Right. Anyway, long story short, when it was over, I'm going, wow, this is for me. And I couldn't even wait to get all the way outside. We were still in the vestibule. And I'm like, you know, what did you think? And she turned to me and said, I feel like I've been to the mass, or feel like I've been to mass for the first time in my life. Hmm. So it was nice that it wasn't a hard sell to get her to, you know, agree to start bringing the family there. Anyway, long story, much longer. when that priest retired, our erstwhile bishop decided that that traditional mass should retire with him. Hmm. That in contradiction to the Ecclesia Dei document, that it really wasn't for the people, it was really for the priest. And therefore, you know, we don't have any right to it. And, you know, it was under his auspices and no more traditional mass. So I actually wound up going to a independent mass. It was a little chapel that had been started by a homeschool co-op that had a retired priest who would come and say mass for them. And anyway, the whole story is in the book. The point is that I'm an apologist. I work for St. Joseph Communications. I'm on the radio with Scott Hahn, for heaven's sakes. How do I justify going to some independent chapel? You know, that's clearly illicit because it's not in union with the local ordinary. I'm sorry, I'm doing both jobs now. I'm asking the questions too.
No, I'm enjoying it. But, no, please.
Anyway, the answer was, I mean, at least the justification that I gave to myself is simply that I can go to this mass, which is extremely Catholic in every respect, but it's illicit because while it is valid, it's illicit because he's not in union with the local ordinary. Or I can go to my diocesan church and go to a mass that has been rendered illicit by unrelenting, imbecilic liturgical abuse. Hmm. So, you know, which one do I choose?
Right.
And present it to my, and I don't know if that's really fair or not, but that was the state of mind I was in at the time. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, when Benedict XVI came along and put out the motu proprio, and I discovered that there was going to be a traditional mass at a diocesan church a little further down the road once again, but in full communion with the bishop and the pope and so forth. And man, I left a skid mark on my way back into full communion. And I was actually kind of surprised that more folks at the traditional independent chapel had not done that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's the other reason I wrote the book, you know, because I want people to understand that traditional Catholics are just people that actually have the Catholic faith and want to experience it in its fullness. I mean, primarily there are some people that are, you know, a little off the bend, but that's true everywhere. Mm-hmm. But, and that's the thing too. I did want to be able to sound that note of caution that, you know, people can, I mean, Bishop Morlino actually wrote an article on this back in, I think, 2015 or so that was really good, where he said, you know, what starts with good intentions, you know, you want a reverent mass, you want the formation of your children, you know, they want to have a good community for them or whatever. But he says, you know, the longer you stay in that situation and when you place yourself in opposition to the hierarchy of the church, at some point it becomes a badge of identity, you know, and even a badge of honor. Right. You know, now I'm Robin Hood in Sherwood Forest and I'm the only one that's doing the right thing. And unfortunately, that can lead to, you know, this very critical spirit. And that's not good for anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask, you know, why you thought that the floodgates didn't open and, you know, they run to the nearest listed traditional mass. But yeah, that makes sense because it's so easy for you to identify yourself. Is I'm the person who stands apart. You know, I'm the person who, you know, has got the real deal and I discovered it and it's me, you know?
Right. There's that. And it's also, you know, some of it's just, I mean, I have a, you mentioned at the beginning, I have a certificate in Christian counseling. Mm-hmm. And I earned that back in around 2005, I guess, is when I got the certificate. And I had to do, you know, study psychology and go through all these various units of stuff to get that. And frankly, I mean, I would be a terrible therapist. My idea of therapy is like, if you have a problem, well, you know, buck up. it's pretty much my approach. But I wanted to gain some insight because I, you know, and you will understand this as an apologist, so many people leave the Catholic faith for emotional reasons.
Yes.
I mean, right. They use doctrine to justify that decision after it's been made. You know, they made the decision with their heart and they justify with their brain. And, you know, yeah. And knowing that doesn't make you immune, obviously, because I was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's that pain is real. I mean, a lot of these people were legitimately marginalized and unfairly. And, you know, it's hard to forgive, but it's also a requisite if you're going to be a Christian.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if people can appreciate the depths of that, of seeing what you hold most sacred, you know, being desecrated by people who are supposed to be shepherds, who are supposed to be leaders, you know. That's a huge spiritual wound. You're absolutely right.
It is. And I think, you know, I mean, kudos to Benedict the 16th for trying to bridge that gap, trying to put a Band-Aid on that wound. You know, I mean, for decades, you know, a lot of people see you got the traditional mass, and it's true for me, because it was a refuge from heterodoxy of various kinds, all too often justified precisely by appeals to the Second Vatican Council or its ill-defined spirit, you know. Mm-hmm. And for decades, Vatican II was depicted as a radical break with the church's tradition. You know, you have Catholics on one extreme using that interpretation to justify the most unprecedented novelties, you know, and this is my favorite expression, views at odds with the traditional teaching of the church. And then you've got the people on the other extreme that are using that interpretation as a break with tradition to condemn not errors and abuses, but the new mass and Vatican II itself, you know.
Right.
And Benedict XVI comes along and says you have to use what he called the hermeneutic of continuity and not of rupture. That you have to see Vatican II in its proper place as a council in the church, and you judge or interpret the documents of Vatican II in light of the tradition that preceded it. You don't reinterpret the tradition in light of Vatican II, right? The hermeneutic of continuity. And that is, I mean, it's so important and so routinely ignored by people on both sides of the liturgical fence.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, we're chatting with Master Apologist Matthew Arnold about his book, Confessions of a Traditional Catholic. On the other side of the break, Matthew, how about we talk about the spirit of Vatican II a little bit?
You got it.
All right. Stay tuned, folks. You're listening to Hands on Apologetics. I'm Gary Machuda. More on the other side of the break.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, you know, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and you know, I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of put me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle and he says to me, "Hey, man, I've been listening to Terry and Jesse's show and it's great. And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a week. He goes to the mass in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's an on fire Catholic and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio."
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity. Be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show. And they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Master Apologist Matthew Arnold and about his book, The Confessions of a Traditional Catholic. And Matthew, you gave a great analogy about, you know, sola scriptura-type person, how they view church history as looking down a well, where it's just this cylinder of darkness, and then there's the other end, which is a reflection of themselves. And I was thinking, as you were describing those two different erroneous approaches to Vatican II, that they're kind of committing the same thing, aren't they? That by not seeing a continuity of history.
Sure, excess and defect, right? That you've got the continuum of virtue. And it's like that with the hermeneutic of rupture, that you decide that, you know, all bets are off in the tradition of the church, and that's great. Or all bets are off in the tradition of the church, and that's awful. And, you know, and somebody's sitting there going, you know, there isn't any expiration date on the truth. This all still holds.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, right.
Whether everybody chooses to ignore it or not, this is, you know, it's still the teaching of the church. Right's right. St. Augustine, right? He said, right is right, even if nobody's doing it, and wrong's wrong, even if everybody's doing it.
Right. Yeah,
And that's, you know, that's the place where you find yourself. And it's interesting. You mentioned before the break, the spirit of Vatican II, mm-hmm. You know, that was the appeal of people that thought the documents of the council didn't go far enough, but that they had, you know, but there was this revolutionary spirit that needed to be carried on. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, in light of that, I think that was very influential, because there's a lot of stuff going on in the church, got nothing to do with those 16 documents.
Yeah.
And of course, most Catholics haven't read them.
Yeah, and, that's the same bet.
I think so. Well, I'm a medievalist. I don't know. There isn't a club. You know, I'm not a capital M medievalist. I don't know if there is such a thing. But I love and study the Middle Ages. And it was in the 19th century when medievalism really kind of appeared on the scene. And it was, you know, for a lot of people, they had a very romantic view of the age of faith. But that's where the liturgical movement started, with people kind of trying to recapture that medieval liturgy before all the polemics of the Reformation came along. Mm-hmm. You know, that idea that the water runs clearer closer to the source, you know, so we're going to go and you have the whole neo-Gothic movement and architecture and all the rest of it. Yeah. And, you know, it was the liturgical, Pius X is the one that gave us the axiom about the active participation of the faithful, right? You don't associate, I mean, we associate that very much with the new liturgy, right? Even Sacrosanctum Concilium, which is the Vatican II document on liturgy, says that in the renewal of the liturgy, the active participation of the faithful is to be the primary consideration.
Right.
So this is a big old deal. Everybody's got to, but you know, but what does that mean? I mean, for Pius X, it was everybody was supposed to learn the Creed and the Gloria and the Sanctus and all the responses in Latin. Mm-hmm. And that's sure not what we got wound up with, you know. By the time 100 years went by, people had a lot of different ideas.
Right.
And unfortunately, and that's, I'll say one last thing about this and then turn the direction of the conversation back over to you. But it occurs to me that we live at a time when, you know, a traditional Catholic, for me, I don't call myself a traditionalist.
Yes.
Right. I don't believe in traditionalism. I believe in Catholicism. Okay. I would call myself a traditional Catholic, but what does that mean? In my definition, that's not exclusively someone that only goes to the old Latin Mass, or the, you know, the extraordinary form of the Mass, as Benedict XVI would have it, or prays his rosary in Latin or whatever. A traditional Catholic is someone who can say the act of faith and mean it. Who's someone who can say in his heart, to God, I firmly believe all the truths that the Holy Catholic Church believes and teaches, because thou hast revealed them, who canst neither deceive nor be deceived. And if you say the church needs to change its teaching on X, Y, and Z, or this used to be true, but it's not true anymore, or whatever, and I'm not pointing any fingers, but what I will say is that's not, you know, the traditional Catholic approach.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very well put, because you're absolutely right. You don't want to, the only ism you want is for Catholicism, right? If you're any kind of other ism and then Catholic at the end of it, you kind of made your own universe, you know, you've created right. your own reality, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
And that's not Catholicism. Catholicism's universal. Yeah, right.
That's correct.
So, yeah, that's a great point. So where exactly are the boundary lines? How do you become, well, actually, let me put it this way. See, you stopped asking mm-hmm. questions. Now I'm fumbling. Maybe you should just continue to ask questions. What I was thinking of is that you're absolutely right, because believing the faith is really the cause of all these problems, whether it's on one side of liturgical abuse or the other. You know, it's really a lack of faith.
It is, and what's happening? I mean, I don't put a whole lot of stock in psychology, but this is real. And that's cognitive dissonance. Yeah. When something you believe very deeply is dramatically challenged, you know, you will not want to stay in that tension. You will try and resolve it one way or another. This is why one of those things, like, you know, we have traditional Mass on holy days at our parish. And they usually do that. That's the noon Mass. And there's people that work or whatever, and they come there at noon, and they don't know it's going to be a traditional Mass. So, yeah. You know, one time I was a couple of older ladies, and they were coming out, and they were talking, oh, I haven't been to a traditional Mass, and I don't know how. Hey, boys, you know, must have been 50 years ago. No, no, you know, they're having this talk. And I said, well, what'd you think? Wasn't nice? And she's like, no, I prefer the new one. And I'm like, wow. I mean, she just like Jekyll and Hyde, you know? Switched over. And I thought, well, yeah, but it's because that's how she resolved that cognitive dissonance with the oh, things were much worse before the revolution, comrade, you know. Yeah. That's how she dealt with it. And it is, you can see a lot of kind of the older people that were there for this whole liturgical thing and stayed faithful and stayed in the church are very much, you know, very militant about things are better now, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's interesting that we're seeing, you asked about a boundary. I don't think there is so much anymore. And this is one of the things that Benedict XVI was hoping for. I mean, when he put out Summorum Pontificum, he wrote a letter to the bishops where he said that he thinks the two forms of the Roman Rite can be mutually enriching.
Yes.
And I can anecdotally, that's true. I mean, I've seen it all over North America, all over the Anglophone world. I mean, North America and England, Australia. Those parishes where they have the traditional Latin Mass, they typically have a much more, sober celebration of the Novus Ordo, may say.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really easy. I mean, the last chapter of my book, I borrowed from Dr. Peter Kwasniewski, all of the things. If you look at the general instruction of the Roman Missal, there's a lot that a priest can do to make his celebration of the Novus Ordo more consonant with the traditional Mass. I mean, just by avoiding some of the more popular options, you know, you would go in there and be like, oh my goodness, you know, this is where this come from. You know, it's like a time machine.
You know? Yeah, right.
Even though it's, and it doesn't require any special training or spending any money or saying anything in Latin, even,
yeah.
You know, just using the more traditional options, make that the celebration of the Mass, it just becomes inherently more dignified.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's key to bringing back reverence.
Yeah. That's how the extraordinary rite informs the ordinary rite and enriches it. How does the ordinary rite enrich the extraordinary rite?
Well, one of the most striking things I've seen, and I've seen this like in Lake Charles, Louisiana, or there's a group of priests who are Augustine canons were founded by a former Anglican. I'm sorry, I feel terrible because their name escapes me at the moment, but they're using, because Benedict put in his letter these acceptable options, one of which making the readings and the prayers that are unique to the that particular day, mm-hmm. right?
You can
collect and the introit and so forth of the day and the readings of the day, to do those in the vernacular. You know, just that alone. And then to spend time training the congregation to make all of the responses and to do, because really, I mean, that's what Pius X was on about. He's talking about the Gloria and the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei, and the Domini non sum dignius and the, you know, Dominus vobiscum et cum spiritu tuo. Virtually everything that we sing or recite in the Novus Ordo can be sung or recited by the congregation in the traditional Mass. And that's the thing that I'm seeing, which I think really comes close to what the Council Fathers were shooting for at the Second Vatican Council.
And that's
one thing, because they really have drilled in that idea about active participation, you know. And so I think maybe it's taken us 50 years to kind of come full circle, but I think that's what we're seeing. That's the influence of the Novus Ordo on the old rite.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I guess it's a little bit off topic, but I had a little run-in with a nun, you know, very kind, beautiful sister who, when Benedict XVI came out with permitting, you know, the older rite, she was appalled at that, you know, we're going mm-hmm. back in time and stuff. Oh, I said, but sister, yeah. You know, I think, you know, the Pope, I applaud the Pope for his liberality, that we're no longer constricted to one or the other, but right. Now, you know, there's all these different, you know, options that you could go to Latin or you could do English and that. And the funny thing, she thought about it. She said, you know, you're right. I mean, you know, it's funny how, you know, this idea of, you know, freedom and options and stuff, it doesn't occur that, you know, the Pope Benedict's actually opened it up for even more options, you know.
That's right. That's why I like to refer to Summorum Pontificum as the liberation of the traditional Mass.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so in that sense, it was a very liberal thing to do.
Absolutely. Which kind of confounded her at first, but then she agreed. Well, hey, Matthew, how can people get a hold of your book and other things that you do?
Well, golly, you can go to MatthewArnold.org, and the book's right on the homepage there, and then there's links to all the other stuff that I do. You can certainly go to Ignatius.com, because it's Ignatius Press is the publisher, or, you know, Amazon, or even your local bookstore. There's lots of that was one of the great joys of my life, to walk into a bookstore and just see my book there. It was like the coolest thing ever. Catholic bookstores primarily. You're not going to find it probably at Barnes & Noble. but you can get it through all of the usual channels. Yeah, and it's Confessions of a Traditional Catholic.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Gary.
All right. Matthew Arnold, everybody. By the way, you can check out Happy Hour on Virgin Most Powerful, Fridays 1 to 2 Pacific Time. It's the fastest hour on Catholic Talk Radio, I swear. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center, turn off the dojo lights here. I hope all of you enjoyed the program. Coming up next, the show that started it all, the Terry and Jesse Show. High impact Catholic talk coming at you. And I hope everybody has a wonderful, blessed day. And God willing, we'll meet again tomorrow. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app.
I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.